All right, so we're going to move forward according to my little syllabus that I gave you guys. Just, again, sort of looking at different pieces of Augustine, trying to get a sense of the way he's often been understood and maybe even to challenge that sense a little bit. I see him, I think, a little bit differently than some other people do. Some people pointed out that I see him perhaps even a little bit differently than one of my colleagues, Dr. Pechnold, if you're familiar with him. you can decide yourselves which of us sees him more correctly, but it's worthy of conversation, perhaps over dinner or drinks. All right, so one of the things we're going to discuss today is there are kinds of sort of standard approaches to Augustine, and particularly to sort of dividing the moral Augustine from the political Augustine. And I think in some ways that division of St. Augustine's own corpus, or even sort of his plays itself out in the way Catholic ethics and Catholic moral theology has been sort of proceeding for the past 25 years or so. And that's to divide the sort of morality of St. Augustine's thinking from its politics, and in particular, the sexual morality of St. Augustine's writings from its politics. No surprise, I find that division probably is not the best thing either for St. Augustine or for the Church. So the standard sort of approach to Augustine's sexuality, his reflections on sexuality, which of course are tied to his own erotic desire, right, is to see his desire as more or less a corrupting influence of the entire Western Christian tradition, and perhaps even of Western civilization itself, that somehow this, poor North African boy's difficulties with, right, controlling his libido, plays itself out over the course of the next 2,000 years, more or less, in Western history. That's probably not the best way to look at this, but I want to give you proof that this is the case. So, Augustine invents sex, right? We're dead over here? Okay, sorry about that. All right, this is actually a New Yorker article. I don't know if any of you guys saw this or not, but the subtitle of it is, "He rescued Adam and Eve from obscurity, devised the doctrine of original sin, and the rest is sexual history," right? So I'm going to click there and let's see if we can get there. Are we going to be able to go there? It's not there. Well, anyway, there's an article here in the New Yorker from 2017 on this issue, and it's an absurd article, which is no surprise. This is a little bit of a quotation from it. I'm sorry that it's not over there. I'll read it. "The archaic story of the naked man and woman, the talking snake, and the magical trees was something of an embarrassment." Write this. "It was Augustine who rescued it from the decorous oblivion to which it seemed to be headed." Right? So Augustine rescues Genesis, right, from obscurity. He bears principal responsibility for its prominence. I mean, look, I love that they're giving Augustine props, right? But something else. "He bears principal responsibility for its prominence, including the fact that 4 in 10 Americans today profess to believe in it." So he, right, is responsible for 4 in 10 Americans that have professed to believe in its literal truth. "During the more than 40 years that succeeded his momentous conversion, years of endless controversy and the wielding of power," he wielded power, "and feverish writing, he persuaded himself it was no mere fable or myth. It was the key to everything." Okay, that's probably true. They think Genesis was the key to everything, but probably not in the way they think. And of course, I wish I could show you the article. In the article, at one point they start talking about his confessions, right, and how he writes his confessions, and they have to remind the reader in parentheses, Augustine is speaking to his God in his confessions, right? His God, of course, is kind of funny about it, right, because Augustine would never say that. And also, nobody reads the confessions, right? They're assuming an illiterate audience. Anyway, right, this is the kind of standard, even secular, right, way of understanding Augustine's influence on the West, right? All of our Western sexual history really ultimately points back to Augustine. And in fairness to this author, actually, she does a better job than many Catholic theologians, right? Many Catholic theologians, of course, look at him at, more precisely as the point at which sexual morality in the church goes off the rails, right? That he becomes, his obsessions about sexuality, his obsessions about his own carnality, they might argue, they do argue, a couple of them at least, his repulsion at his inability to control his literal inability to control himself, right, which he writes about, sort of evinces this kind of disgust at the body, right? He's anti-body, he's anti-sex, and so on, and this leads to Irish frigidity or something like that, right? Many centuries later. But what's interesting about this approach, right, aside from it being enormously reductive and minimally an unpersuasive reading of Augustine on sexuality, is that it's joined to a kind of claim about his political indifference, right? That ultimately, if you read, especially the City of God, right, and that's where we typically go to read Augustine's politics, what you see there is kind of, it doesn't matter attitude. Right, so sexual obsession, moral obsession about around sexuality in particular, but then when it comes to politics, a kind of, well, you know, what does it matter anyway? I'll give you some quotations that are typically used to support this notion, right? And again, people, when they go to, you know, talk about his politics, they go to the City of God. I think that that's a mistake to go there only, or maybe even to go there first. But, you know, I'll make that case a little bit. So this is this kind of quotation that fuels this sensibility that it really just doesn't matter, right, what happens in the world politically, right, just keep yourself sexually clean and all is well. The heavenly city, or rather the part of it which sojourns on earth and lives by faith, makes use of this peace only because it must, right? There is a peace that the earthly city, right, maintains. The heavenly city makes use of that only because it must, right? Kind of grudgingly, until this mortal condition which necessitates it shall pass away. Consequently, so long as it lives like a captive and a stranger in this earthly city, that's, right, of course, the heavenly city, right? We live like, if you're in it, like a captive and a stranger in the earthly city, though it has already received the promise of redemption and the gift of the Spirit as the earnest of it, it makes no scruple to obey the laws of the earthly city, right? It'll obey those laws. But it doesn't matter to us, right? It doesn't matter to those who are members of the earthly city. They're merely captives. They're strangers in that city. There's no sense of deep affection for it, right? The intuitions of patriotism that we might have as, you know, men and women who live in different nations. Those intuitions are probably false intuitions by this account. We should instead have this attitude of, but we make use of the peace because we have to, right? We make use of it because we have to. There's nothing more there than that. And here's another quote. For as far as this life of mortals is concerned, which is spent and ended in a few days, what does it matter under whose government a dying man lives if they who govern do not force him to impiety and iniquity, right? So far, both from City of God, this book. 5. And by the way, if you have any questions about anything, don't hesitate to stop. Okay. Right. Again, a kind of cultivated indifference to things. As long as your laws don't force you to do impious and evil things, what does it matter what kind of government? What does it matter whether it's Trump, right, or Mussolini, or Xi, right, or whoever, right? It just doesn't matter what the form of government is to a good Christian. Okay, this is for a little bit later. All right, so I think you can see how this, you know, arguably plays itself out, right? On the one hand, right, we know this is the typical accusation of the church, right? Sexual obsessiveness, right? Obsession about sexual morality. On the other hand, arguably a kind of indifference about what happens in politics. Sometimes you see American Catholics arguing, you know, over these kinds of things. You know, on the one, you know, hey, you're spending too much time thinking about abortion or contraception or so on, or you're not thinking about it enough, right? Or the churches, right, sort of getting wrapped up, you know, at the Episcopal level over those kinds of questions. And then saying about the politics, you know, let prudence reign. We can sort of more or less survive under different kinds of governments. We'll proceed without too much concern. And in some cases, you get a kind of suspicion, again, about too much attachment to the earthly city, right? Too much attachment being a kind of evil, the attachment that expresses itself, of course, in nationalism being a particular kind of evil, arguably. And if you distinguish nationalism from patriotism, which I think one should, patriotism itself could be suspect, right? Okay? All right? But I don't think this is ultimately fair to Augustine, like I said. I don't think it's fair either as a kind of biographical account of what he thinks about sexuality, and I'm not going to go into that in depth. If any of you has ever read his stuff on marriage or his response to Julian, which is a kind of long response, and it's not typically read, you see there's very complicated material in there, you know, excellent material that, again, can sort of lead one, right, to certain kinds of conclusions that some people have advanced, people are, you know, sort of arguing against. On the other hand, I think it's pretty clear. It's a much more nuanced position. It's a position that is suspicious of the operation of sexual desire, right, as a problem for the human being, even in circumstances where human beings appear to be doing good things, right? I think Augustine is still suspicious about the effects of original sin on carnality. Nonetheless, I think it's much more careful than people think. But more important, I think, for us, as we think about politics and the relationship of law to civil law, to positive law, I don't think this is a fair account of the way he thinks about governance and the way he thinks about politics more generally, right? I'll make more about this point tomorrow in the context of thinking about Rome and empire. But here I want to just show us that Augustine is actually rather passionate about the way he thinks about citizenship and the way he thinks people ought to live their lives. And the first way to do this, before we get to the Donatus, is to look at a book that nobody looks at for his politics, and that's on his Free Choice of the Will. Okay? That's an interesting text for a lot of reasons. It's one of his earlier texts. It's a text in which he pretty explicitly discusses the law and the relationship of the eternal law to positive law. So it's kind of surprising that people don't look at it. But I want to sort of talk about some other aspects of it. First, this is one of those texts that's written in a dialogical form. Again, it's an earlier Augustine. It's when he's, you know, most influenced by the Neoplatonists. And he's drawn to that rhetorical style, and he writes this dialogue between himself and Evodius. Who's Evodius? Anyone that know this text? Who's Evodius? No, that's a different young man. But he's of course by this point out of his life, as his mother has sent him away with a concubine. But who is Evodius? Is a Roman citizen. Okay, Evodius is a Roman citizen. And that's the important thing here, right, is that Augustine is engaging this citizen, okay, a citizen who's concerned, or who's a noble person, right, a person who's fully embedded in Rome. And Augustine and he are having a discussion about freedom, of course, about the nature of laws, and about beliefs more generally. And in the course of this, Augustine makes a point that Thomas will later quote about law itself. An unjust law is no law at all, right? This is a kind of famous Roman statement. It predates Augustine. It's not only Augustine's, right? This is not something he creates out of nowhere. However, his utterance of this in this text is something that becomes canonical in the tradition. Thomas uses it, Gratian uses it, right? They all point back to Augustine. So, he's not indifferent to law. He's clearly making this point to a Roman citizen who he feels rightly is bound by law generally, right? As a Roman citizen, Evodius and Augustine, right? They're both Roman citizens, are bound by law. And you can see in Augustine himself, he feels a great sense of gratitude about being a Roman citizen. You see this most in the City of God more than any place. He does not diminish what it means to be a Roman citizen, even though, again, sometimes people would make you think that it is of no matter to him. Secondly, the dialogue includes this very quick exchange between the two of them where Augustine asks Evodius about the nature of like a good community. Imagine, he says to him more or less, a good political community, stable, its laws are just and not corrupt, right? Would one be bound to that community, he asks Evodius. And Evodius says, I mean, a good community like you described, of course I'd be bound to that. Well, Augustine says, well, imagine over time, right, that this community becomes corrupt. I mean, it's a very brief description, but it's a description that, you know, you can apply very neatly to different places in the world at different times. And one might even argue, you know, here today, right? Well, imagine over time those laws become corrupt, right? What is the stance of the citizen in a situation like that? And what sense is he bound by those laws? And Evodius argues, well, he may not be bound any longer by something should it be as corrupt as you're describing. And Augustine agrees, right? That there could be a point when a good society, right, a good, we'll call it a state, right? Of course, they don't have states then yet, but, right, a good state becomes over time corrupt and ceases to seek what is good for its citizens, right, ceases to uphold laws that are right. And Augustine and Evodius agree. This, first of all, happens, right? States change over time. They are temporal. And over time, right, they kind of do this. And sometimes they just, you know, collapse. And in those circumstances, Augustine makes an account that later theologians will point to, and it's about this long, right, is a kind of revolutionary, right, initial revolutionary account. So Augustine, who on the one hand, right, can say the sorts of things that I had up on the screen a minute ago that leads some people to conclude he, right, there's a kind of political indifferentism in him. Take whatever you get, right? Make use of it. You know, you're a member of the heavenly city. It's of no matter to you. Here is telling Evodius, sometimes we're not bound, in fact, by corrupt regimes. Well, the corrupt regimes. Okay? All right? Yeah, I'm sorry.
Is the category in both cases is the capacity to make use of it? Is that correct? I mean, so in the first instance, you have a worldly regime that you can make use of.
Right.
And in
right.
the second instance, you no longer have a worldly peace that you can make use of. So, I mean, in both of these cases, you're talking about contingent state of affairs, right?
Great question. Yes. In general, yes. The difficulty, or the fun, right, comes in the fact that any regime that is maintaining order, and Augustine will say this at times, right, any regime maintains a certain amount of order, right? And in as much as they do that, citizens of the earth, the heavenly city, can still make use of that little order, right? So there's always a capacity to make use of almost anything, right? Even like tyrannies. You can still make use of the little, like, a good example of this recently would be Iraq under Hussein, right? There's a balance, if you think about like peace and justice and order, right, or stability, there's a balance between those things, right? And sometimes in wonderful places you might have a kind of high level of justice and high level of order, and therefore a relatively good, you know, embodiment of peace. In other places you might have very different things, right? So a relatively high level of justice and a pretty low level of order. So it might actually be a relative, you know, a kind of, you could even argue maybe the United States in a sense is something like this, right? But I don't think that's quite accurate. But there's a lot of freedom, right? A lot of freedom, and therefore a lot of justice to do, live the kinds of lives you want to live, right? Laws that allow you to live the kinds of lives that you live. But there might be less stability because of that. So you have the kinds of disagreements we have as a society, right? Disagreements about pretty fundamental things that seem, you know, you get different kinds of arguments. You know, is California going to split into three pieces? Is Texas going to pull away, right? Is, you know, do we want New York to, you know, sort of collapse into the ocean, right? And, you know, are we going to have a civil war over what, you know, right? This is where people talk about this. So it seems like the freedom and arguably justice, right, is imperiling stability. Then you get the other kind, right, which is really what animates him more than anything, because it's what he's more familiar with, which is the kind where you have lots of stability, lots of, you know, order, at least externally observed, right? There's a military or a strong police force that is maintaining, even if it's, you know, only, again, external or by appearance, but it's maintaining the roads, maintaining stability, maintaining the laws with regard to property and so on. And people think, okay, like, maybe Iraq was sort of like that, right? Hussein kept a lid on minority issues, right? Minority religious issues. Was there justice? No, right? There was very low level of justice. Justice for the minority ruling community, injustice for at least a few of the other minorities and majority Shiite, right, religious communities. You pop off that order, and then you get a kind of flowering of disorder and, right, and so on. But that Augustine would say, like, look, even there, a Christian persecuted as Christians were, in a sense, right? There were minorities. They didn't have the full rights of other people in Iraq at that point, but they were not being slaughtered, right? They were not being removed from towns and cities the way they are or have been since, right? Once you get rid of it. Christians can make use of that kind of tyrannical order of somebody like that, and they will, and they know it. And they also know that when the persecution comes, it's, you know, a mark of the church to be persecuted. You bear it, right? You have a sense of it. It's kind of fit punishment for our sinfulness, Augustine says at times, right? Right, these things are all sort of at play in Augustine, right? And it, you know, to your question, but here at least he's emphasizing that there may come a point, and you could argue, right, that what he's pointing to, given what he said about the unjust law, right, is the point where the laws are actually forcing you to do things that are evil, right? Right, so it's not simply a kind of making use of the order, the little order that's provided by even a tyrannical government, but it's the point where the government is actually forcing you to do things that are evil, right? And that may be the tipping point. But again, you know, it's not systematic, right? So he's again topically engaging these kinds of questions here a little bit more theoretically, or in on free choice of the will, a little bit more theoretically than in City of God and some other places where it's a little bit more attached to some particular concerns. But all of these things are kind of swirling around, I think. There. Yes. I know the last name was a little bit. No, Al. I'm Al.
I'm Al.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, go.
I don't quite sure stability and justice. You know, that they can be justice without stability.
Right.
That's a little bit too easy. Yeah. A just society is always stable, but stable for the right reasons, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Stability is not a value that's like good in itself. But
sure.
Just society needs stability for the right reasons because people adhere to the just institutions and have a sense of justice in these things.
Yeah, sure.
So I wonder whether Augustine says more about the different forms of stability there can be.
Yeah. He says more about justice, right? He says more about the different kinds of justice that there are. And what we really get in his account is that there's, and this is related to the argument that it's indifferent, that there's never more than the best case is an admixture of injustice and justice in this world, right? That's all you ever get. But to your point about, you disagree,
those are my categories, sort of imposing, you know, trying to think through them, you know, and I grant them, right, that real order would require real justice, right, in this, in fact, you know, in a sense, they're terms that are more or less getting at things from a different, same thing from a different perspective, but they're not used, I'm not using them as, like, ideal types, more just as descriptions of the way societies are, right, and I think it's defensible in that case. Like, again, to think about places where you have a certain amount of stability, and then what happens when the stability is absent. You're right that there's, as I said, there's not always necessarily justice there, and stability is not a good in and of itself either. That's true, too. But it's a good you can make use of. Right? It's an instrumental good. And that's, I think, part of what's going on here, too. Philip's new question is the language of use in Augustine, right? We know that Augustine's going to use that term with his, right, its twin term, enjoy. We don't enjoy the stability of the world, right? We make use of it. It's just something, right? Because it's not something, you know, in which you could rest. It's not something, it's not a final end. It's just an instrumental good that provides us with something here. So it's, when you think about what it means practically, it means, like, look, it's actually a pretty good thing, for instance, right, to have been in Iraq under, you're saying, if you were a Christian, by comparison, being in Iraq under Al-Qaeda, right, or under ISIS, he allowed us to practice our faith, right? He gave, right, our churches were not, generally speaking, going to be overrun by guys with machine guns who were going to slaughter us, right? Or we were not, generally speaking, there's some, you know, other cases where this is not true, going to be removed from our town by something. Is that a just order? Of course not, right? Of course not. But it's a kind of order. And, you know, again, you could make similar, you could use this to sort of think through, I think, political situations around the world. But am I missing the point? I think I agree in terms of, like, ideals, right, that you want to say anything that's truly stable is truly just, right? That's the point?
Well, truly stable for the right reasons.
Truly stable for the right reasons? Yeah. The point is, I think, for me to make use of it, I don't need it to be truly stable for the right reasons, right? I wish it were. Right, but if it's not, if it's just because there's a strong man at the top, right, I'll make use of it. You know, I don't know that I'll argue against it. And for politics, right, think about politics, international politics, even, right. You can't diminish the value, right, of even, I think, even a kind of partial order that's built on wrong reasons. You know, before you decide, okay, we're going to reorder that situation and try to get it built on the right reasons. You know,
this may get too much of what you wanted to talk about tomorrow, but the question generally about how do we, terms like city and citizen, in this period, because, of course, there is still something like Roman citizenship, there's still some kind of plebiscitary participation in lawmaking, but most people that live in Rome, it's very...
Right. Right.
Spread it across the empire, and yet still, like, these terms from the Greek tradition are still how political thought is done.
Right.
And so how to sort of map that on modern concepts like state, right?
Yeah.
At least difficult.
It does.
I sort of never know how to read that in these, like, these late Roman texts.
Yeah, it's a good question. Right, I think we want to, generally speaking, avoid the term state. I usually will use the words governing authority. Place of the state, but I mean, all of these things are a little bit imprecise. In terms of your point about Roman citizenship and its relation to participation, I mean, that's clearly correct, right? Nonetheless, there are classes of people who know themselves to be Roman citizens, and they're living among people that they know are not Roman citizens, right? And there is, if there's not a kind of immediate political payoff in the sense of, okay, we have some, right, relationship with the way we are governed, there is a cultural payoff. And you can see this in Augustine. He, like I said, I think he actually
you know, expresses a certain amount of, I'll say pride, you know, a little bit hesitantly, but he gains some pleasure from the fact that he's Roman. He expresses a real concern, affection for and concern about Rome. And even a sense, and this comes up many times, you see, you've got a sense of its real achievement by comparison to some of the other, here's the language again, cities or empires or, you know, societies that have come before his. But the point is taken. We're just, you know, you're using a vocabulary that, you know, try to make sense, to try to communicate to people as much as possible what we're talking about here. And, you know, Rome is clearly not the United States in any, you know, in any way. On the other hand, we can make comparisons between the two of them. It is a governed place. There are classes of people who understand themselves to be involved in its governing, and there are classes of people who understand themselves to be outside of its governing, even though they remain citizens. And then there are classes of people who are neither, right? They're not citizens, nor are they involved in its governing. There are a lot of Americans who think of themselves, you know, in sort of similar ways, right? That it's, we're being governed by something above us. We don't really have access to it, despite it. And these could be ways of sort of thinking through and comparing them. Did you have a hand? No. Yes, Father.
Brother.
Hey, brother. Brother. Thank you. Brother. Thank you. Yes.
So, yeah, in pathology, we were told that when Augustine couldn't convince the Donatists or some religious member, so he called for a help to Roman military to come and subdue those he couldn't convince. So I don't know how true is it in the history, but my point here is to argue concerning how can we understand that in terms of relationship between the city of God and the temporal city. Knowing that Augustine always gives precedence of the city of God over the city of men, so to speak. So I don't know your stand or your take on this view.
Okay, I'm sorry. So I want to make sure I understand the question. First thing is, we'll look at the Donatist thing right now once we get done with this. Okay, so we'll look and see what he says about the Donatists. But you're asking, tell me if I'm right.
Yeah.
You're asking about the relationship of the city of God to the earthly city?
Based on the fact that when he couldn't convince the Donatists, he called for Roman military to come and...
Okay, let's start there then. Okay, let's start there. Okay, so just as an example of how Augustine really does care about the political situation and really does care about what's happening right around him, right, I thought we'll look at the Donatists situation, okay? And what do we know about the Donatist situation? I think most of you have some sense of it, right, that this is a group of people who think of them as genuinely Orthodox, right? They think of themselves as, the genuinely Orthodox religious community, the true followers of the faith, because why? What, do you know why? Why do they think of themselves as, in fact, the Orthodox? What do they refuse to do? Yeah?
To accept priests who had surrendered to the Roman authorities during the times of persecution.
Right. So during...
Given up the faith.
What was that?
Well, given up the faith.
Right, they refuse to turn over the texts, right? And the Catholics were readmitting the priests who had turned over the sacred texts of the faith. The Donatists, as what's your name again?
Roger
said, right, would not readmit into the fold those who had basically betrayed the faith. So you had on the one hand, Catholic churches readmitting priests in, recognizing as valid the sacraments associated with those priests who had handed over the text to Roman authorities, to imperial authority. The Donatists, on the other hand, both denying their readmission, requesting their rebaptism, right, their repentance and rebaptism,
if they were to be readmitted at all, which of course Catholics, you know, think of as wrong. Also being the dominant church at that point in North Africa, Donatists were by far the majority church in North Africa when Augustine is dealing with their issue. As Brother said, Augustine's impulse initially is not to call on Roman authority, right? Not to call on governing authority to force the issue, to coerce the Donatists back into the fold. He understands the good of freedom, what we call, you know, negative freedom, right? Freedom from coercion. Augustine understands that powerfully, discusses that in many different places, and is hesitant to call on the authorities in order to bring the Donatists back into the fold. However, eventually he does. He relents and argues the fact that he was wrong. His initial position was wrong. And I want us to look at a couple of texts where he kind of spells out what, you know, he thinks about the issue and how he thinks through it. This is the first section. A couple of them are just from this letter 185, but there are multiple letters where he writes on this issue and multiple other places where he deals with it. First one, this is from paragraph 21 in the text. It is indeed better, as no one could ever deny, that men should be led to worship God by teaching, than that they should be driven to it by fear of punishment or pain. But it does not follow that because the former course produces the better men, therefore those who do not yield to it should be neglected. For many have found advantage, as we have proved, and are daily proving by actual experiment, in being first compelled by fear or pain, so they might afterwards be influenced by teaching, or might follow out in act what they had already learned in word. Okay? So what is he arguing here? Okay, what's the first thing he concedes? He concedes something at the very beginning of the text. Yeah.
He says teaching is better than making people scared.
Right,
but
right.
They both can work. And there's no reason not to use the second if the first doesn't work.
Right. Okay, so teaching is better. To learn by teaching, right, to come to believe something by teaching is the better way. Right? That's the first thing he concedes. And then he adds that sometimes people come to believe things or come to see things or do things by fear. Right? And even though the one way is the better way, that doesn't mean you can't have recourse to the other way. That seem all right so far? I mean, look, I'm not asking you to agree with it or anything like that, but does that seem faithful to the text? What is this stuff about it produces the better men? What do you think he's getting at there?
Produces more, at least more faithful, more devout Christians. Maybe it produces truer Christians in some sense.
That's right. One of his initial hesitations about using coercion is the experience he's already had with coercion used to compel belief, where he thinks what it produces is people who pretend, right? People who pretend. Right, and he uses the word feigned, right? People who feign religion, right, or feign faithfulness. So he's concerned that, at least initially, that if we use coercion here, all you're going to get is people who are pretending to be faithful, and that's actually going to erode the community of faithful.
Yes. Yeah. When he says compelled by fear or pain, is that what you mean by coercion? And
yes.
If so,
yes.
What's the difference between the legal authority being the one to do as opposed to, say, the words of Jesus in today's gospel, woe to you, whatever, that you didn't believe, which is a kind of compelling by fear.
Soft and hard coercion, right? Soft and hard is going to be the thing in this class.
Okay. It's not clear that he's talking about political authority, at least from the words on the page.
Right.
I don't know the whole context.
But he is. He is talking about the governing authorities. What was that?
Take
their property away, right? It's not tying people up to things and beating them. It's not, it's not the infliction of physical pain. It's primarily the government basically revoking property, handing it over to the Catholic Church,
dispossessing private individuals even of things. Those are real things, right? Those are real sanctions, they're not fake. But he does not spend any time discussing coercion, like what what he means by this and what would be acceptable or unacceptable limits to it. He's appealing to what they know to be going on, which is this real thing, right? This real dispossession of property. Yes, Paul.
I follow this on a natural level because Aristotle in the Nicomachean Ethics talks about how there are people who will be convinced because they're reasonable, but most people need, he doesn't say coercion, but need to be trained and through reward and punishment need to be formed in habits.
Right.
So to me it makes sense on the natural level.
Right.
But on the supernatural level of faith, is there an analogy then that Augustine is saying, yes, that on the outward form that you can shape people, guide people, and that over time through habit they will internally...
Sure, are you responding?
Yeah.
Okay.
Especially in the last couple lines, it seems to me that what he's essentially getting at is that by they can be coerced into listening to teaching, so that teaching might then lead them to faith, but the coercion itself is not going to lead them to faith. At least that's the way I'm reading it.
I think that's absolutely right. I think he still believes, as he said in other texts, you cannot actually compel somebody to believe something, right? What you can do is shock them. You can sort of wake them up. You can force them to listen to something that they refuse to listen to. And the forcing, in a way, is by depriving them of goods, right? By shaking up their world a little bit. And at that, again, remember, like, he initially thinks, all I see around me is people who fake believe, right? So he knows the problem, right? He knows the problem of, okay, you said this is going to work, but initially, right, all I'm worried about is but the problem of fake believers and how eventually that actually corrodes the community of believers, right? But then, and he says this explicitly too, I actually see the fruits of this, right? I see people who really do now believe, and they believe because they were, as I said, shocked out of a kind of habituation, to use your language, into a false way of believing, right? There's a lot of hands on this. All right, so I'm going to go like this, okay? I'm going to go back, then Amadeus, and then Luke. Yeah. Joseph.
Sure. So in this passage, scholars take this to mean temporal punishment or sort of temporal involvement of other heretical Christians at the time. Or has this been interpreted to mean a sort of spiritual fear of the pains of hell that has its own merit?
This is explicitly, precisely government action, right? Temporal action. And Augustine will appeal to texts that show that, look, this is nothing by comparison to the right what we're also told, which is a kind of soft coercion,
right?
There's another punishment for this that government cannot, of course, do, right? The government can't give you spiritual punishment or the punishment that actually fits false belief, right? That's the punishment that actually fits false belief, would be that kind of thing. So he says, look, if that actually is in play, this is nothing by comparison to that. Again, the great good here is spiritual, right? Ultimately, yeah.
So does this prescription only apply to fellow Christians? I'm thinking of Thomas, right, and how the Jews had their own legal order.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, this in fact applies only to these guys, right? These guys who left the faith. Right, these guys who were among us, they're our brothers. He refers to them as our brothers throughout this. You're our brothers, come home, basically, right? And it's because of this relationship to the church that we can do this. This is not go out and compel everyone into the fold. It's these false believers. Is that your question?
I just did a seminar on religious freedom with the ARLC, and there were a number of people in the readings that we had for that who were not Augustine scholars, but were going passages like this and essentially reading Augustine as sanctioning the later actions of the church against Jews or like in Norway. And that seemed to me at the time just to be an incorrect reading of what Augustine's getting at here.
Right.
And so I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, no, I think that that's an incorrect use of these kinds of texts. It's really clear. I mean, even again, you look at the salutations. It's, you know, my brother, I think this is Boniface, my brother, right? This works. Come back. This is why we're doing it. You argue something else. There's also stuff in here about you guys start the fight, right? This is a real conflict, right? It's not just kind of cute. They believe one thing on one corner, and we believe another thing on another corner. There's, you know, there's actual blood in the streets over these kinds of issues, right? It is not merely a religious issue. It's also a political issue, which arguably makes it more suited to a political response, right? In the sense of it's less inappropriate, you know, to say governing authorities really need to be doing something here. These guys are actually hurting each other.
Just a minor point to make sense of this. I think it's maybe helpful to use the notion of internalization and to...
Of what?
Internalization.
Okay.
Of a doctrine, for instance, because you could argue that internalization of something is never a passive endeavor, which means it cannot be coerced.
I can't
be coerced or internalized at a doctrine.
Right.
You know, but I must get active myself, you know, to see the considerations that speak in favor of that doctrine.
Right.
So that's why coercion can only be used to, you know, make me able, enable me to...
If it can be used, it can only be used for that, right? If it can be used, right? I mean, you still can argue about whether you could even do, right, the coercion of the thing in order to force somebody to listen or to sort of shake them up to listen. But he would agree, it actually cannot make anybody believe. It cannot make them internalize the thing. Yes?
The phrase he uses elsewhere in his letters is the gospel phrase, compel them to come in.
Mm-hmm.
People can be forced to hear.
Yeah, right.
Or to be in circumstances in which they are receptive.
Yes.
But the receptivity itself
is
not enforceable.
Right. That's absolutely right. Okay, yeah. Here and then, brother. Okay, since you started this up,
My question is just quick. Is there something here in Augustine's thinking about the objectivity of the virtue of justice, wherein justice is a virtue where you cannot want to do it, but as long as you take the steps to be just to the other person, you are virtuously being, you're participating in justice. So if I owe you $10, I really, really, really do not want to give it to you, but I end up paying you the $10, I'm still participating in justice, and religion being kind of a just due to God.
Right.
Is he thinking along those lines of, this is one of those things where we can force people to do it, because it's right to do it whether or not they willfully do it, kind of like a child being dragged to mass, kind of when I was as a child.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that answer would rub up against the points that were just made, in the sense of, you can't force a person to give the justice to God, right? You can't force that person actually to believe. But what you can do, right, and what could license Augustine to write a defense of coercion is recognize the great good here that you, in fact, do owe God, right? You do owe him this. I can't make you believe, but what I can do is compel you to come in. What I can do is give you an occasion for the internalization of this. Right, but I can't, you know, I can't actually make you drink the water, right? Is that responsive? Yes?
Somewhat.
Okay, good. Brother.
I wanted to know, is it that for Augustine, even though compelling is not the better choice for him, I want to know if for him, temporal law can help the natural law in terms of someone being inclined to the divine.
That's
what I wanted to know here.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I think the answer here is clearly yes, right? The temporal law can do this. He's looking to temporal authority, in fact, to step in here. And of course, if you acknowledge the temporal law can assist in the fulfillment of a natural justice issue, right, which is devotion to God, right, you could also then conclude it can be an obstacle. As well, right? Temporal law can be an obstacle to this also, right? Philip.
So first, this would be an interesting instance, right, of making use of the order or stability or justice of the world of the city.
That's right.
Then secondly, I think the important thing to keep in mind about the Donatus situation is that he's also concerned about, in particular, like the rustics, right? The folks that aren't actually thinking this through, it's just their neighborhood church happens to be a bunch of schismatics, right? So
right.
you've got right. the virtue of charity is what's in enabling you to, you know, depose the deceiver, you know, the people who do think about this, who are actively schismatic, so that you can bring back into the fold all the people who just, you know, go to church. What do you mean? You know, this is where we go worship the Lord, and they don't know they're schismatic in the same way that.
That's absolutely right, and I fortuitously hit the slide because this next one you see some interesting language here that gets to this point. I mean, I think it's pretty clear. Like, I would say there are like 3 points here that sort of obtain. Right, one is there's a kind of role aspect to it, which goes to questions about is this for Joseph's questions about is this for anybody, and the answer is clearly no. Right, it's for these people who are in our community who have now right. We now understand to be outside of the community. Second is your point about charity. Right, that this has to be done for the good of those, right, who need it. So it's actually an act of love. It's an act of charity. And Augustine will make this point. And the third is truth. It has to be true. Right? This has to be true. This is only doable because it is true. If it's not true, right, if it's not loving, and if it's not cognizant of the precise nature of the dynamics here, then this he would not justify it, I assume. Yeah, Joseph.
So in the Roman system of law, did you have various clerical courts for different religions?
I don't know that.
So I guess is Augustine writing about this sort of hypothetically?
No, to governors. I mean, he appeals to governors. But here he's responding to somebody else, but he does also appeal to governors and say this is your responsibility to do this.
So the governors then most likely did involve clerical, well, these sort of...
I don't know, they have to actually sit in commissions as opposed to, simply respond, or even just responding to the influences that are right most... pressing upon them. Let's just read this one real quick. But God in his great mercy, knowing how necessary was the terror inspired by these laws, right? God knows this was necessary, and a kind of medicinal inconvenience for the cold and wicked hearts of many men, and for that this hardness of heart which cannot be softened by words, but yet admits of softening through the agency of some little severity of discipline. Right? Euphemistic, right? But it's but we take the point nonetheless. Accordingly, when the great mass of the people had been received by the true mother with rejoicing into her bosom, there remained outside cruel crowds persevering with unhappy animosity in that madness. Even of these, the greater number communicated in feigned reconciliation, and others escaped notice from the scantiness of their numbers. But those who feigned conformity, right? Again, this was a concern that he had, right? Those who feigned conformity, becoming by degrees accustomed to our community. That goes to Paul's point about a way, like, they habituate into it, even when they were faking, right? Eventually they habituated into it, and hearing the preaching of the truth, especially after the conference and disputation which took place between us and the bishops of Carthage, were to a great extent brought to a right belief. Okay, so you see, right, and this, Paul is, you know, really great in bringing this up earlier, that this is not automatic. Right? This is a kind of blow to something, a shaking up of something which occasions the opportunity, and I think this goes to your point as well, Philip, for those who have been believing falsely now to reconsider their beliefs and gradually believe correctly. I love this language of medicinal, right? This is important. It points to the notion that this is charitable and that this is true. Right? This is not toxic. This is not false. It's medicinal because it's true. Okay? It actually cures these people of their cold hearts, of their hard hearts. And were it not true, it would not do this. Okay? All right? Got that so far?
I think I have, oh no, that's it. That is the last of them. And like I said, there are sort of three operative points here, right? Again, the, what were they again? Charitable, truthful, and occasional, right? The right occasion. Otherwise, I don't think Augustine would have justified this. We could talk about how alien this is to us, right? To see somebody justifying something like this. This is clearly the freedom for type model, right? I talked about Augustine, you know, really does respect freedom from and is hesitant to do this, initially opposed to it. But you can see here he recognizes also that there is a kind of freedom for by the agency of discipline, right? People can be brought to something that is better for them, that is actually helpful for them. He uses language of even making them freer in other places. But it still probably clangs against us a little bit, right? The notion that governing authority would be called in to shake people out of false belief in order that they might believe appropriately. Yes?
I was just curious if Augustine, in making maybe this point here or in a different place, does he not allude to the analogy of parents? Because this whole time I'm thinking, it's the only way you raise a child. You kind of have to tell them, you know, yes, you don't want to eat your vegetables, you'd rather have some more cookies, but you have to eat your vegetables. And if you don't, you can't have dessert afterwards. It's that's a kind of need to compel, but everyone sees how loving it is in a family. It's odd, I don't know, it just strikes me as odd not to allude to that, which I think everyone would understand intuitively.
Right, and McIntyre used to always use the example of piano playing, right? Like when you first sit a child down to play piano, right, it's just experience of suffering, right, great restriction on freedom, right, and of course, there doesn't appear to be any reward for it because it's playing, 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 drunk, right, you know, and it's kind of miserable for everybody around it. But eventually, by a little severity of discipline, the child can play piano, and not only does the child often gain some enjoyment from that, they also are now free to do things they couldn't do before. Now you can make music, right? Now you can read music. Now you can write music. You can do things that's absent that severity of discipline, whether it's self-imposed or imposed externally, right? You couldn't have done before. Yes.
Do we say that?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Do we say that this kind of coercion can only be used on other Christians, people who were part of the flock, because they have some disposition? So Augustine wouldn't say you can use it for just pagans because there's some lack of disposition in them that would make it not work.
What do you guys think? Is it about disposition or is it about something else? Yeah.
Well, I mean, I would imagine it might have something to do with the fact, you know, that the Christians are baptized, whereas the other people, you know, the pagans aren't. So there's a certain sense of, you know, authority that the church would have over the baptized that could, you know, express itself in this way.
Right. Father, I'm sorry. Yeah.
I was actually.
You've had a hand a couple of times. Yeah.
No, I was actually going to ask the very same question.
Yeah.
To try to hone in on how Augustine saw this intervention. If it was an intervention by the empire on behalf of the bishops who were requesting it, who were, you know, because of their own lack of temporal power, couldn't exercise the paternal right and discipline
right.
that they felt they needed to exercise over their flock, who they still viewed the donors as part of their flock,
that's
right, they're baptized.
That's right.
And so I was just wondering about like the how Augustine would see which competent authorities are operative, and
there are also already Donatist bishops at this point as well, right? This has been going on for roughly a century, right? So I mean, this is a significant schism in the church, right? That requires the exercise of some authority. I think it's very precise in terms of who could be the target of this. I'm going to go to a couple people who haven't spoken yet.
This is related to the question Desmond asked about whether he uses the parental imagery. And two times he uses the same sort of example where he says to not discipline someone who's doing something wrong is the same as a parent saying, my son is holding a knife and playing with it. but because I'm afraid he'll cry if I take the knife away, I won't take it. Use that example with my son's playing with a snake. If I don't take the snake away because I fear his tears, then I'm not truly loving him because it's better for him that I restrict his freedom in this sense. So he does use a parental hand examples here.
There's also, I think it's letter 173, maybe this letter, I think it's 173, where the recipient of the letter throws, you know, had thrown himself into a well recently and it was rescued by people. And Augustine's like, was it not good that, you know, contrary to your will, that they actually rescued you from, you know, the harm you were about to do to yourself? But he does use parental imagery all the time, but which is, you know, important and of course, good. On the other hand, to go to how it's discordant with the way we think, right? We're anti-paternal in our culture, right? So that, he says, hey, this is like, you know, a parent disciplining a child for the child's own good, probably is not going to be very effective with many of our peers, and maybe even some of you, right? Geez, I know what's good for me, or, you know, nobody has that authority to do this. Yeah.
I'm sure you might be that beyond the topic of the session, but I was questioning the list. So I have the impression that St. Augustine here presents the traditional position of the church, that is that the church has the authority to coerce the baptized and the integrity of the faith and for their own spiritual good.
Right.
How does this reconcile with the embracement of religious liberty of the church over the last 50 years? If that's beyond the topic of the session, feel free not to understand.
No, it is. So what we could table that. We actually have a session on Friday, which is a kind of freewheeling thing. I'm happy to, if you're happy to just table it until then. I don't think we have anything planned specifically for that session. Don't we have a kind of freewheeling, hey, let's look at some issues that came up in the course of things?
Yes.
And I don't know that anybody's going to be talking about libertas or dignitatis humanae. Are people talking about dignitas? Okay, so look, are you cool for just putting that off until then? Yeah. I mean, that'd be fun to discuss in this context and the context of a couple of other things.
Paul is furrowing his brow.
No.
Okay.
I just have a question. I don't know if Augustine, I know some people draw connections between Augustine and St. Paul, but in St. Paul's own biography, there's some interesting parallels where
yes.
He...
he does draw these connections.
Okay, good, because the church, the synagogues bring Paul in front of the Roman authorities, and there's the whole trial, and then it's when he appeals to Caesar that everybody backs off and says, okay, well, we got to send him to Rome.
Yeah.
So, to the earlier discussion about Augustine's satisfaction, at least, with being a Roman citizen, it seemed like it helped Paul a lot, but it also, I guess, in the order of grace, enabled Paul to speak to a lot more people and
mm-hmm.
tell the gospel.
And Augustine makes that point in a couple of different places that... it's actually a wonderful thing that the way that Christianity emerges in the Roman Empire is providential, right? That it does, because this allows it, accelerates the process of it becoming a universal faith. So that's good stuff. Yeah, you've not spoken, right?
Right.
What was the status of the rule of law in the times of Augustine? Like, was there a general understanding that, like, it's more like paternal where you have a lot of discretionary freedom, or was there a strong notion of being bound?
I'm not an expert in Roman law, but I mean I know a little bit in the sense a little bit enough to be dangerous. As you might imagine, laws that are passed in Rome have sporadic effect on the rest of the empire, right? And where Augustine is, of course, in North Africa. You know, the likelihood of what's happening in Rome actually impacts them is going to be, again, sort of random, up for grabs. This is a specific appeal to governors, you know, to act in Numidia, right, in this province, and they do act. And they dispossess the donatists of their churches. Look, this stuff happens. I mean, I was saying, like, you know, how it kind of clangs on us, right? These things happen still. Right, we still have, I mean, aside from whether you could argue there are secular analogs to this kind of activity, where our own government shakes us up about certain beliefs we might hold by certain kinds of rewards and punishments, right, which we could discuss on Friday, if there are things that are like this. You know that, right, there are still religious communities that argue over who owns what, right, and whose property it is, and go to the courts, right, go to our, you know, political system to resolve these kinds of disputes. And they'll take property from one and say, okay, actually, you guys, you know, we recognize that you guys are actually the owners of this thing. So I just, you know, I was kind of leading, in a sense, towards that as a point that, again, this does sort of reverberate in our heads as some sort of antiquated practice, and there's good reason for that. On the other hand, I think if you look at it a little bit more closely, recognize the precision with which, you know, he's making this point in terms of the occasion, and to, you know, your point about the kind of coercion that's involved here, it's property claims, more or less, it's not that alien, what's happening here. It does raise the question about religious liberty, right? It does raise the question about, you know, the doctrine of religious liberty in the church, to what extent, if at all, there's been a development on this, what extent, you know, in other words, what people say about this is simply wrong, right? This is simply a problem. He made a misstep here. His initial intuition was correct, and his later about-face was not moved by argument, but moved by other things. That makes sense? Yes, okay, so two over here, yeah.
Luke, just on this, I mean, there is sort of a discourse that's sort of like the rule of law in Roman law, but I mean, people did this, there was no precedent for an idea of religious neutrality in Roman law, right? But the understanding across the ancient world is that the law is inherently religious,
that's right,
and that, therefore, purely imperial authorities intervene in matters all the time, at least both imperial cults. And so a Roman tribune in North Africa would be used to litigating these kinds of things.
Great point.
Not, maybe not necessarily the Christian bishop, but the general precedent was there.
Great point. Michael?
And
then Philip will be last.
I'm thinking about the way the difference between, so here Aquinas or Augustine distinguishes between teaching and fear of punishment or pain. And he associates law, it seems, or political order with the political coercion with fear of punishment or pain. I'm thinking about the way Aquinas yesterday said that law is teaching, right? Whereas here it seems like Augustine's saying, well, you got sort of law over here, or at least human law, positive law, and that's fear of punishment or pain. And over here you have teaching, right? And I'm trying to reflect on, to what extent is that distinction between that approach is one that is just a mode of, like, that Aquinas is a different mode of inquiry, right? Or to what extent is, it's not just like Aquinas, to me feels a little naive, maybe.
Aquinas?
Yeah, because he's not engaging in particular situations, like Augustine is here,
yeah,
in which we all understand his distinction,
yeah,
right? That it's really going to be hard to say that the use of taking people's property is a kind of teaching. We recognize that as a kind of perversion of language, I think. And I'm just interested in that as I think worthy of thinking about the way that Augustine is approaching these political questions through particular instances,
yeah,
and what that at least helps me to see. That things get ugly pretty fast. I guess that's one thing that I'm noticing here.
I think these are great points. I don't think we can get into them right now, but I think they're great points, and maybe I don't know if they'll come up when Father Dominic talk a little bit more, but we should return to those too. I mean, there's a lot of interesting stuff there, and I don't even know. In the back of my mind is a couple of things Augustine says. One of which is that you cannot be taught evil things, right? Teaching is only about true and good things, and that's a point he makes in on free choice of the will. In the course of talking to Odius, teaching is normative, right? There's a normative conception of teaching there. And also, in the same place, he says that unjust law is no law, right? So you can see a kind of, right, convergence there, perhaps, of the relationship of truth to both of those things, and maybe they're kind of getting pulled together a little bit in a way that might be appropriate to Aquinas. But there's a lot of good stuff.
That's what our Greek word naive, which sounds like an attack.
You're feeling the pressure of the three guys?
It's actually that I learned.
That's fear of punishment.
Aquinas is carving into the scenes of reality. I saw that when Father Dominic took us through it yesterday. But Aquinas is getting at something else, I think. Augustine is here. I don't know, it seems to me.
Well, it's really good stuff. I think we're going to stop soon. So just, no, we'll get you guys. So Philip, and then Joseph, brother, and then Amadeus, and then we're done.
Okay, go Philip.
So,
and I won't say anything.
As one of Stanley Kammerwasser's students, I feel as a matter of filial piety right now. It's my duty to say that.
Good, go for it.
This is the reason why it's bad for the church to have temporal power. Because there are particular corruptions that it's tempted to, which is to make justifications on the basis of charity for dispossessing killing people, right? And that this is just, in fact, a bad idea. So this is just my...
That's good stuff. Okay, you've done your duty.
The next time I see Stanley at the Society of Christian Ethics, I'll tell him that you said false things.
I did your duty on his behalf.
So you mentioned earlier that Augustine talks about the unjust polity, which is the kind of worst case scenario where Christians are compelled to against the truth and the good. Does Augustine prescribe any responses to that? Rebellion, raniment, all the other approaches that are addressed in
Christian history. All polities again are unjust in certain ways, according to Augustine, right? That's all we ever get. We just get degrees of injustice, or degrees of justice, right? And no, he doesn't prescribe anything. He does, as I said in On Free Choice of the Will, talk very quickly about that moment when a regime becomes corrupt and seems to say that the person is not bound by that. Disobedience, right, being different from now let's change the thing, right? And, for most, as you know, right, for most of Christian political history, there's been a real reluctance among Christian theologians to justify rebellion. Now, Thomas talks about it, right? Calvin talks about it. But there's this very narrow space, for it, because there's a kind of conservatism in the Christian. Right, that as Augustine says, we don't merit better than a tyranny by our sinfulness. Right, if we get a tyranny, it's just punishment for human sinfulness. It's kind of that's dark Augustine, right? There's no it's beneath us that we live in a tyranny, and this is why Nietzsche hates it, right? Among others, right? Nietzsche finds this despicable. Well, right, liberation theology, slave theologies, and so on, right? Slaves, do your duty, right? Not rise up and overthrow your masters, do your duty. That's what Christianity tells them. And this, Nietzsche, right, vomits over. Who did I have? Brother than Lord.
So I don't know if Augustine addresses to which extent can we punish people because some can harden their hearts in the end. So to which extent?
To what extent?
So the punishment he is talking about, to what extent? Because people can be stubborn till the end, prefer to die than to come back to what you are calling as combat.
Yes. Okay. Here, he's just talking about what the government is doing, the dispossession of things. Elsewhere, he seems okay with, at least in certain circumstances, the death penalty. He does also write letters to governors appealing to their Christian sense of mercy and say to them, you have the right to do this. He does not deny the right of governing authority to do this. In other words, he does not say it's bad law that governing authority is permitted to execute criminals. But he says, you're Christian, you don't need to do this, right? Mercy, right, would compel you or lead you to recognizing an opportunity here to, right, release that person from it. So punishment is the full rage for Augustine. And there's a wonderful passage in the City of God about the judge, and you know, and the application of torture by judges for inquisition. We know more about this. So learn facts about cases. Yeah. Last word.
I wanted to briefly add on to what Michael said because I also thought about like comparing Aquinas and Augustine on this point. Because he said that Aquinas in a way says that law is teaching, but he also, if I remember correctly, uses the notions of discipline and law as
Aquinas,
law as a means to making people virtuous, which is comparable. So, maybe we can talk about in the next session about this and how far they differ or are, in a sense, saying similar things.
Real quick, so a lot of people argue Augustine doesn't have that in him, that he does not have the notion of law as cultivating virtue, right? It's that all, like I said at the beginning, we'll discuss in my last class, there are people who think he's just a good proto-liberal, right? That for him, the laws are merely laws of restraint. But I think you see here some evidence. Again, it's occasional, so we have to be careful about it, but you see here, some, and there are other places where you see some evidence, he's not a proto-liberal.
Not a surprise.